of things I want to talk about this morning, mostly having to do with what would be called Paul's conversion, this famous story of Paul on the road to Damascus, where he is changed from being one of the most ardent persecutors of the early Christian movement to its first and in some ways its most profound spokesperson, the one who opened Christianity beyond the narrow confines of Judaism and really made it a global faith that is universally inclusive. And then I want to talk a little bit about Peter and this funny story this appearance story in the three times that Jesus inquires of him, "Do you love me? Do you love me?" First thing with, I think in both cases of Saul, Paul, and Peter, what we're seeing in action is what it means to take resurrection as a metaphor. You know, you can be quite literal about resurrection so that it pertains to what occurs after death. But in the New Testament, so much of what is talked about as resurrection is really a spiritual metaphor for changes that occur in this life. And I think it's most clear in the life of Paul how committed he was to a vision of the God of Israel as he understood it. And I think he shared with so many of Jesus' contemporaries this profound suspicion of the God whom Jesus proclaimed. I mean, remember, Jesus was thought to be an atheist, a godless person, primarily because the God of whom Jesus spoke was not confined to authorized channels. This God worked everywhere. And I think we as human beings do not particularly like it when we are out of control. And this is, I mean, one of the primary challenges that Jesus presented, not just to the religion of his day, but to the religion of any day, is religion, you are not in control. You do not tell God what to do. You are responsive. You are a servant. You are not a master. And I mean, the reasons for the fear that Jesus inspired are many, but this is one of them. The religious establishment said, "What do you mean, a God who does not work through our authorized channels?" Paul was hugely committed to this. You could even say his whole self was built on that understanding of what his mission in life was. And the voice on the road to Damascus changed everything. And what I think is important to understand is that Paul, in a sense, had to die at that moment. Not a literal death, but a metaphorical death, a spiritual death, that everything he thought his life was about started to change. And the very thing that he had set himself against, now he found himself becoming the most passionate advocate for. And I guess one of the questions that always occurs to me when I read a story like this is, would I allow myself to change that much? Or differently, in your life right now, what kind of changes are being asked of you? What kind of changes are being asked of you that your life, actually, I mean, there's that wonderful line from T.S. Eliot. He's talking in the Four Quartets, and he speaks about the shame of motives late revealed. The shame of understanding that we thought we'd been doing one thing for so many years, and we'd really been doing something else. We'd been working with a motive that was not entirely clear to us. So I mean, one of the questions that always comes to us in this tradition is how deeply are we willing to be known? How much self-understanding will we actually allow? And then will we change, even if it's slightly, even if it's incrementally, in honor of what we now know to be true? Well, which is to say, you know, we have that petition in our prayers: "Help us, O God, when we know what is right, to do what is right." And that little movement, when we know what is right, will we put it into practice? And that often requires of us some significant change in the way we understand ourselves and others. And never think those kinds of changes are easy. We put a lot of energy into sort of building a self. This is who I think I am. This is what I think I stand for. These are my values. And if that starts to change in a radical way, it is very, very threatening. So I think those are the words of Jesus saying, you'll have to go something that will feel to you like a death. But on the other side, you will be reborn and you will find a new center for your existence. Not the center of what you can get just for your own isolated little self, but this the self that is based on what you share with everything else, the life that you share from a common creator, from a common God. That's a different foundation for your whole existence. So those are the kinds of changes. And Peter is having to go through a change sort of like that as well, you know, suffering through the humiliation of his betrayals. And obviously, the three betrayals are recapitulated here in three sort of affirmations. You know that I love you. You know that I love you. There's a little change in the third where the word shifts from one form of love, agape, to a different form of love, philios. And it's almost like the inquiry changes. Jesus says, do you love me? Do you love me? And then it's almost like he says, do you like me? And that's very different. You know, we can often say, oh yeah, I love that person, but I don't really like them. And the love is a kind of an obligatory thing. And I wonder how much of our religious life has that kind of obligatory love at the center of it. And not so much of, yeah, I like Jesus. And if we don't like Jesus, I think we have missed something really fundamental about him, which is he radiated human well-being. I mean, I've used that line before. If you want to change the world, throw a better party. And Jesus was the guy that threw a better party and made people feel, this is my home here. I belong here. I can relax. I feel at peace in a way that I've never felt before. So this is an appeal. Don't just love Jesus in that sort of weary, obligatory way. Like him, because he was throwing the best party of all. And it's a good party to get invited to. Second thing, or whatever, I don't know where the list is, about this relationship between Jesus and Paul. Again, I want to draw our attention to how different this encounter is from almost every other depiction. We continue to tell the story. We have enemies, and how do we defeat our enemies? How do we get rid of them? How do we eliminate our enemies? And that is not the Christian story. The Christian story is never about the elimination or the death to our enemies. It's about their transformation so that we actually do become one family, a human family with one God who has created all of us. That's the Christian vision. And so what you have here is sort of an archetypal Christian moment where the one who is committed to killing every Christian he can find becomes its most passionate spokesperson. Paul is not eliminated as an enemy. His heart is changed. And that's what makes him cease to be the enemy of Christianity. And it's the one who opened it to the Gentile world, who opened it to us. Evil is not to be destroyed. It is to be converted so that as Jesus says, nothing that my Father gives me is lost. So how do we go about rethinking the way we stand in the world? I mean, again, the public conversation that we have is all about boundaries and divisions and exclusions, who's in and who is not in, whom shall we fear, and all of those boundary lines make a mockery of the Christian path. There is one living world created by God, and it's up to us to figure out how to perceive it in that way and how to live according to the wisdom that says nobody and nothing gets thrown out. Not even Paul, terrible enemy. No, the voice says, I know he has hated us, but his heart is about to change. And he is an instrument that I have chosen for my work. Maybe we should look at the world around us, maybe look at our own hearts and say, what is the work that I am being called to in this great, great path of reconciliation that has been made known to us?